Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Well, we're on the internet, so I gotta open with prayer just for the show. So you guys are early. Nobody else is here yet. Yeah, I don't know where Corinne and Carmen and Carol are. The folks will come in as it's their turn to be a little bit late. That's right. All right, let's open with prayer. Lord, we do thank you for this new day, and we do thank you for the chance to be together. And we ask that you would be with us as we continue our way through the book of Romans. Give us your wisdom, open the eyes of our heart, and help us to see you and see the world. So hear our prayer in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. Okay, now we've been through Romans 1 and 2. And we'll do a little bit of review. Romans 1, often it's 1 through 8 or 16, is sort of considered an introduction. And then 1, usually 17 or 18, to the end of the chapter, talks about Gentiles. And Romans 2 talks about Jews if they violate the law, and we've talked a lot about that word law. They're no better than the Gentiles, although in 1 it talked about the suppressing of knowledge of God and how they understood how Paul was talking about God in that sense. And now we're going to, well, let's we've used an illustration about, we've talked about sort of two senses of the law. Let's call them law number 1, which is sort of immediate consequences. And law number 2, which we would say is mediated consequences. All right. So I use the example of a stove, and a mother tells a child not to touch the oven because the oven is hot. And so the mother makes a rule, don't touch the oven or don't play with the stove. If the mother is making the rule, it's a mediated consequence. The mediated consequence is, if you touch the stove, you're not going to get dessert after your meal, or I might send you to your room, or you might have to go on a timeout. So that's a mediated consequence. What might be an immediate consequence of the child touching the stove? Child would get burned. So we talked about mediated and immediate consequences. We also used an example of speeding down I-5. Let's say doing 150 miles per hour down I-5. What would be the mediated consequence of speeding down I-5? Okay. So the police, in that sense, getting a ticket would be the mediated consequence for speeding. The immediate consequence for speeding could be a crash. All right. Paul also made the point that you have God. And the Jew and the Gent and the Greek, Paul usually says a Greek, meaning someone other than a Jew. The Jew and the Greek both, in some ways, are under God and are responsible to God for their behaviors. And if the Greek is behaving better than the Jew, the Greek will receive the benefit, and the Jew will receive the consequence. And this is both immediate and mediated. And that sets up the beginning of the third chapter, which is where we're going to start today. And he ended the second chapter with this discussion about circumcision. Why would he pick on circumcision as the difference between the Jew and the Greek? Circumcision was the law. Circumcision was the covenant agreement going all the way back to Abraham, setting aside the Jews from the Gentiles. And so at the end of chapter 2, he finishes, circumcision is indeed of value if you obey the law, but if you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. So in other words, he's using circumcision not only referring to the physical ceremony, but he's using it metaphorically to talk about a commitment to the covenant and a working one's way out of the covenant. So if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as a circumcision? What does Paul mean by that? His uncircumcision be regarded as a circumcision. The LEB says, uncircumcision be credited for circumcision. He's basically saying that if the Greek keeps the law, it's as if he's fulfilling the covenant by virtue of his actions and will be rewarded by it. What's that? Clean and unclean. It's like he's clean. Very good. Yep. Then those who are physically uncircumcised but keep the law will condemn you who have the written code but break the law. Okay? So one way to think about this, again, is the mediated and immediate. Even though the Greek doesn't have knowledge of law number 2, the mediated law, even if they keep the law that they've sort of inferred by looking at the immediated world, they will be blessed by it. For he is not a real Jew who is one outwardly, nor is true circumcision something external and physical. Okay. What Paul is saying here is that true circumcision, now that's connected with the covenant is all about keeping relationship with God. And we talked about immediate and immediate. And so both the Jew and the Greek stand in relationship with God. And if the Greek keeps the covenant, though the Greek does not have the covenant given through Moses, the Greek will receive the benefit of that keeping of the covenant. And the Jew who does not keep the covenant is, in some ways, worse than the Greek because the Jew should have known better. In other words, the child who has felt how hot the stove is, maybe touched it lightly and realized I should not touch the stove, is in some ways better off than the child who has a mother who has given that child the rule, don't touch the stove, but the kid keeps playing with the stove. So in that way, the child without the mother is further ahead and more obedient than the child with the mother who keeps playing with the stove. And that's the point that Paul is making here. For he is not a real Jew who is one outwardly, Nor is true circumcision something external and physical. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and real circumcision is a matter of the heart, spiritual, and not. Now, I have a problem with this word literal because I think it distracts us. Let's look at the NIV. No, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. The LEB says, but the Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter, whose praise is not from people, but from God. Now, Paul has just brought in an internal, external dynamic into this. Let's talk about the corrupt cop. Okay. And talk about the corrupt cop in terms of internal and external. What's going on with the corrupt cop in terms of internal and external? Because it really doesn't work without this distinction. From the outside, what does the police officer look like? Okay. What are the markers of this? The uniform, the badge, the gun, the police car. All of these are markers, external markers, that this individual is a police officer. Now, we've talked about righteousness. And we've talked about righteousness is the thing inside the cop that makes the cop either a good cop or a corrupt cop, right? And so a good cop and the corrupt cop outside look the same. They have a uniform, they have a badge, they have a gun. They drive around in a police car. They're indistinguishable from the outside, but there's a difference on the inside. On the inside, the good cop is attempting to do what? Follow the law and protect the people and create a space of shalom, peace, goodness. The corrupt cop is, well, what kinds of things corrupt the cop? What kind of things do a corrupt cop, does a corrupt cop do? Overly violent, accept bribes, judge people according to, I like this person, I don't like that person. Might be racism, might be ambition, could be whole bunches of things. But that's the difference between the corrupt cop and the good cop. Now, verse 29 of chapter 2. A person is a Jew who is one inwardly, that's righteousness, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a person's praise is not from other people, but from God. Why would Paul say that? We see the external. How does God know the difference between a corrupt and a good cop? God looks at the heart. This is all where this language that we have comes from. God looks at the heart. The good cop has righteousness, dikaiosune. It's what makes the good cop good. The uniform doesn't make the cop good. The badge doesn't make the cop good. The gun doesn't make the cop good. The car doesn't make the cop good. Those are things we look at on the outside to say, can I trust this person? Now, hopefully there's a system around the uniform and the badge and the gun and the car that lends credibility. Lily before said the word authority. These are the issues we're looking at, okay? Now, this is important, what Paul is saying here. This is the last verse of chapter 2, because Paul is getting into a very long conversation in the Hebrew prophets. And that long conversation in the Hebrew prophets, let's say, is about true Israel. Okay. Part of the issue, when you have to use a word like true, you know that a problem has already developed. Because Israel, well, what does Israel mean? You can go all the way back to Jacob for this. What does Israel mean? Jacob wrestles with God, and at the end, God renames Jacob to be Israel. Israel is who wrestles with God. And we mentioned all the way back in chapter 1, when Paul is criticizing the Greek world, his criticism is that they have failed to wrestle with God. They have suppressed the knowledge of God. They have avoided God. They have failed to wrestle with God. And so that has led to the kinds of debaucheries in the vice list that Paul has in chapter 1. They failed to wrestle with God. Now in chapter 2, Paul is basically saying, Israel has had a problem too. Israel has externally had the covenant. We can look at that as, let's say, the Ten Commandments. Israel has had the temple and the sacrificial system. Israel has had all of this. But Israel has, and the symbolism of this has been circumcision. But Israel has not had a circumcision of the heart. Israel has not had the dikaiosune, the righteousness from the inside that makes the good cop good. Israel has, and you can know this because Israel has not kept the covenant. And this is a long conversation in the Hebrew prophets about true Israel. You find it in Ezekiel. Ezekiel has this vision of the temple, and the temple is corrupt. It's all full of images and unclean things. And God is saying, Israel has not been true Israel. And so at the end of chapter 2, Paul lays down a devastating argument. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and real circumcision is a matter of the heart, spiritual, and not by the written code. Such a person's praise comes not from other people, but from God. Now, this sets up a problem. This sets up a few problems. What is the dilemma of the crooked cop? You are in trouble. You see a police car. You see someone in that car with a uniform, and you say, oh, good, help is on the way. Only when you begin to talk to the cop and he begins saying things to you that are not appropriate to the law, you begin to recognize, I'm now in more trouble than when I stopped the guy. That's the dilemma of the crooked cop. And this is what Paul is saying about the Jews. And Paul is not, this is not a new thing that Paul is saying, because Paul himself is a Jew. Paul is saying this because he has read the Old Testament. And the Old Testament says, the Jews have a problem. They don't keep the law. So if you look at the history of the Jews, So we meet, we have in Genesis, you have the patriarchs. At the beginning of the book of Exodus, what do we find? What has happened to the children of Jacob? Okay, they have multiplied, and that is a signal of God's blessing, but they are enslaved. Is their enslavement a signal of God's blessing? That's really hard. We'll leave it there for now. Because this is not uninvolved with this question of the Greeks, and we're going to get there. So they're enslaved, and God is going to rescue them and bring them to the land that God promised to Abraham. Okay? There's the story. And so God rescues them with power from the hand of Pharaoh, and he brings them out into the desert. And this is what usually happens with Bible readers. You say, oh, I want to read the Bible for whatever reason. So where should I start? Well, I always start books at the beginning. So they start reading the book of Genesis. They have all the first 11 chapters. Well, there's kind of interesting stories. Creation and Cain and Abel and the Garden of Eden and the flood and the Tower of Babel. Lots of sort of stock cultural things. Oh, this is why I decided to read the Bible, because I wanted to learn about all this stuff that you hear about. Then you get to chapter 11, and you meet Abram and Sarah, and well, that's kind of an interesting story, and wanting a son, and Ishmael and Hagar, and then Isaac, and then Isaac with Jacob and Esau, and then Jacob has 12 sons, and Dinah's daughter, and Joseph, and wow, what a book Genesis was. That was amazing. Oh, all right, Exodus, let's go. Oh, our characters are in Egypt, and they're enslaved, and Pharaoh is mean, and God wants to rescue them, and Moses is a would-be rescuer, but no, that's not his time, and then God calls him. And then, oh, plagues, and let my people go, and out through the Red Sea, and Sinai and the desert and the Ten Commandments, like, oh, this is all the Hollywood stuff that they made movies of in the 50s, greatest stories. And then after chapter 20, things start getting really boring. You got all these rules. And then, okay, you want to build a tabernacle, but don't you think they're overdoing the detail on the tabernacle? And then, you know, right away, this desert wandering stuff is a problem, and it's not going well. Okay. And in many ways, well, after Exodus, you've got Numbers and Leviticus, more laws. Numbers has some interesting stories. Deuteronomy's a few little stories, but again, more of that law. Then you get to Judges, and it's a little more interesting at first. You've got Jericho and Ai, and then it gets weird for a while too, just a lot of lists and details. And then you have Judges, Samson, and cool stories there. And then you get Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, and you get David, and you get the story of Israel laid out. And then it gets kind of weird and in Kings, and you've got Elijah and Elisha, but then it all sort of starts falling apart. And it starts falling apart because of this covenant. And that's when you begin to understand the purpose of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, because God sets a covenant with his people. And at the end of Deuteronomy, God says, look, if you keep the covenant, you'll be blessed. If you fail the covenant, you'll be cursed. Here's the situation. And the story is, sometimes Israel keeps the covenant and they're blessed. Sometimes Israel fails the covenant and they're cursed. But for the most part, Israel can't keep the covenant. And then you have this exile, and the temple is destroyed, and Israel has to ask herself the question, why the calamity? And what's the answer to the question? Why did everything come apart? They didn't keep the law. They didn't keep the law. Now, this is in keeping with chapters 1 and 2. Keep the law. Don't touch the stove. Don't speed. Don't steal from your neighbor. Don't commit adultery. Don't bear false witness. Keep the law. It'll go well. Violate the law. You'll be punished. But now remember, all the way back to the beginning, what we've been talking about, you've got, in a sense, law number one and law number two. You've got the immediate law of the created order, and you have the mediated law. Israel failed both the mediated law, which is the covenant, and the immediate law. God kept saying things like, if you violate the covenant, the land will vomit you out. That's a weird, weird way to talk, isn't it? The land will vomit you out. Well, when did the land vomit Israel out? Taken into exile. You say, well, that's kind of metaphorical. Yeah, it is. Because, you know, the land wasn't a huge mouth and it spewed them all the way to Babylon. But that's basically how language works. The land will vomit you out. It's not a physical description of the exile, but it certainly is a description of fulfillment of the warning by God. So Paul then comes to the beginning of chapter 3 with a question. And it's a question we have to sort of wrestle with. Then what advantage has the Jew? What advantage has the Jew? Or what value the circumcision? And this isn't a new question. And this isn't an old question. I was just listening to a podcast this morning, and none of the three people on the podcast, two of them identify as atheists, two identified as being rather anti-Christian. But one of them said, I don't know the story of the other one, one of them said, I was raised Catholic, and I certainly don't want to go back there again. Wonder why. I don't know. That's all he said. I don't know his story. Often when I talk to people on the internet, I dig into those stories a little bit. And, you know, those stories can go different ways. I was raised Catholic, and the church was full of hypocrites, and I was treated poorly, and it's a big scam. Or I was raised Catholic, and I kind of liked the church, and, you know, it was kind of boring, and I didn't understand it, but nobody molested me, and everybody seemed to treat each other fairly well, but it just didn't pan out for me. Those are two very different stories. And they're in some ways in this issue of what advantage has the Jew? Because at least for the Greek has been looking at the world, looking at immediate consequences for different behaviors, developing wisdom based on, you know, I felt that stove, maybe, you know, I felt the stove, maybe mom was drunk or neglectful and never gave the rule of don't touch the stove. Or maybe mom was drunk and neglectful, and so I had to grow up cooking for myself. And so I learned about heat and I learned about the stove and I made it. Whereas the child who was rebellious and the mother said, don't touch the stove, all that kid wanted to do is play with the stove. So the question that is asked here, what advantage has the Jew or what value of circumcision, is a difficult one. Now part of, we're going to find this with Paul often, is that Paul often weaves rhetorical questions or the questions and answers of his contemporary interlocutors or his contemporary rivals within the text, and the ancient Greek text has no quotation marks. And so we see, I think, pretty clearly here that verse 31 is a rhetorical question. And that's important for sort of figuring out this next section. Where are the rhetorical questions and where are Paul's answers? So what advantage has the Jew? Because in some ways, if the child has a rule, well, let me say it this way. So doing 150 up I-5, let's say that there is no speed limit on I-5. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Why? It's a bad thing because someone could get hurt if you don't have any rules. So in other words, the traffic laws are a good thing. But now let's imagine that something has happened to one of your loved ones and you need to get to the hospital right away, and there's a whole nest of laws between you and the hospital. And there are cops and there are stoplights and there are all these things. Now, actually in our culture, we have provision for that. What is it? The ambulance, it's the siren. It's the flashing lights and the siren, right? Because when we hear the flashing lights and the siren, it means all the rules of the road are paused for this vehicle who has authority. Now again, they might not be exercising authority in a good way. Could be the cop is a little corrupt and saying, the donut shop closes at 10. I want to get there. Puts on the lights and the siren and speeds through town to get to the donut shop before it closes. That would be a corrupt use of the lights and the siren. But you see the dynamics here. On one hand, someone might say, for certain people, they don't really need a speed limit on I-5. They're competent drivers. They know their vehicle. They can manage things quite well. But generally speaking, what you need for the society, a speed limit's a good idea. Why? Does it mean that a NASCAR race car driver can't drive down I-5 at 150 miles an hour without any trouble? No. A NASCAR driver can very easily travel from Sacramento to Los Angeles on I-5 way, way over the speed limit, with no problem at all. In fact, for a NASCAR driver, that's a piece of cake. There's no big turns. But wait a minute. I-5 isn't just for one NASCAR driver to set a speed record from Sacramento to Los Angeles. I-5 from Sacramento to Los Angeles is full of trucks, 18-year-olds, 80-year-olds, people who are a little shaky behind the wheel. There's a lot of reasons to say, no, we're going to have a speed limit and we're going to have radar traps and we're going to have, you know, cops pulling trucks and we're going to have weigh stations for cops so that the trucks aren't too heavy and damage the road, yada, 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 all of these things. In other words, Paul says here, what advantage has the Jew? Much in every way, Paul says. To begin with, the Jews are entrusted with the oracles of God. All right. Now again, we talked about, I'm talking about law number one and law number two. Law number two is mediated. Law number one is immediate. Everyone understand the distinction? Law number one is burning by the hot stove. Law number one is crashing on the side of the highway. It's built into the context. Law number two is mediated. What is the mediator in every instance of law number two? Well, it's mom who says, don't touch the stove. It's the cop who pulls you over. It's, and when we talked about judgment day, it's a judge. It's God. It's, in every case, a person. Okay, you've got to get to the hospital. Someone's having a medical emergency. Wasn't time to get an ambulance, or you didn't have a phone, or for what is you? So you're cruising down Florin Road. You're trying to get to 99 because you want to get down to Kaiser South. Cop pulls you over. You look in your rearview mirror. You got a cop behind you with the lights. You got one or two choices. You can keep going, or you can stop. I'm not sure which is better. Let's say you stop. What's the first words out of your mouth to the cop? I have a medical emergency. You try to convince the cop. So if you can convince the cop, maybe the cop will say, well, get in my car and I'll get you there right away. In other words, but a person has to make a judgment and a determination about the consequence of violating law number two. So I told you not to touch the stove, but mom, the pot was boiling over, so I turned it off. Oh, okay. It's a mediated judgment, and it's mediated for an outcome that hopefully both parties are in agreement with. Life is worth preserving. A medical emergency is sufficient grounds for suspending the rules of the road. The pot boiling over, which will cause a mess or loss of food or even another danger, is sufficient grounds for pausing the mediated law of don't touch the stove. All right? Now, we've talked a lot about God versus the meta-divine realm. In Greek philosophy, now this is a simplification, of course, you had a meta-divine realm above which the gods acted. And people down below interacted with the gods in order to get what they wanted. In the Bible, you don't have a meta-divine realm. There are no fates. There is no realm above God. Okay? Now, in a bunch of my videos, now this aspect of God, I often call God number one. Now, if you look at law number one and God number one, oh my goodness, I use the same number for both. Why? So the Greek works in this realm, according to Romans 1, has suppressed the knowledge of God. But what can the Greek learn about the stove? Better be careful with it. It's dangerous. Be careful with fire. Don't stick your hand in the fire. The Greek can learn about God from the physical world. But what God is the Greek learning about? The God, the creator God, who made the world. It's exactly what Paul says in chapter 1. You can learn about the creator God. You can learn about his majesty. You can learn about his power. But now, what you have in the Hebrew story is what I often call God number two. A personal God. When the God of Israel rescues Israel from Egypt, talks to Moses, shows up as a burning bush, God is acting in a personal way. He's talking to Moses. He's giving a covenant. He's giving the law, law number two. He is telling them about the world. One of the ways, the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not murder. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother. Let's deal with that one. Honor your father and mother. Because that's one of the trickier ones. Why is honoring your father and mother a tricky law? Notice that the commandment is honor. It's not obey. Now, often, honoring your father and mother means obeying them. But it is not an absolute command to obey your father and mother no matter what. Same with government. Honor the government generally means obey the government. In fact, even the government understands this. And they understand this with, let's talk about war crimes or something. So you've got a soldier who's a private. And the, let's say he's a low ranking, we'll just use Russia now because they're doing this stuff in Ukraine. And the colonel or the lieutenant says to the lower ranking officer, shell that hospital into oblivion. Excuse me? Yeah, I want you to use your artillery piece and I want you to destroy that hospital in Mariupol. And let's say, okay, after a whole series of events, there's a trial. And they're going to look at the shelling of this hospital in Mariupol. And who pulled the cord on the artillery piece? That private there. The private gets up on the stand and the private says, I was just following orders. Even in courts, they say, you're supposed to honor the chain of command. But there are limits that don't burn down the village. Don't rape the inhabitants. Don't kill the children. Just following orders is not an excuse. You are accountable personally to laws that are above the laws of your nation and the chain of command. So the question is, there's a certain jeopardy that comes to Israel by virtue of God's election of her. What is that jeopardy? Israel should know better. And this is always sort of a strange jeopardy, because someone who is only knows God by virtue of the physical world knows less than someone who knows God by virtue of the law. Hey, Pete. Oh, you're going to sit down or you need somebody? All right. He's getting called upon to play. All right. You can always pass out the elements beforehand. So in a sense, so let's say you have a kid in school. And your kid, a whole bunch of kids got caught spray painting cars in the faculty parking lot. And you get a phone call from the principal. Could you come down to the school?
Yes.
Come down to the school. Your son was caught with a whole group of his friends spray painting cars in the parking lot. And your son's defense to you is, well, my friend, let's call him Frank. My friend Frank was doing it and he told me to do it. As a mother, what are you going to say? I don't care whether or not Frank told you to do it. You're my son. I didn't raise you that way. You know better. Frank is held, or your son is held to a higher standard than Frank. Now, you might know some of Frank's story. Frank's being raised by a single mother who has a drug problem, and he suffered from neglect, and he was raised in the streets, and on some level, you know, Frank has a lot of trouble. And so when Frank got into trouble, spray painting parking lots in the faculty, spray painting cars in the faculty parking lot. Frank shouldn't have done that, but everything you know about Frank says, I'm not real surprised. Okay? He's going to have to face the consequences. But given the fact that who knows where his father is, his mother has a drug problem, he's been in and out of trouble, he's had a tough life. But you, my son, I raised you right. I taught you right from wrong. I showed you the proper way. And when Frank said, let's take the spray paint and go spray paint cars in the faculty parking lot, you should have said no, at least minimally, and even better said, you know what, Frank? I don't think that's a good idea. You're not going to help yourself with this little stunt. It's not going to end well. I mean, if you're Frank's friend, you should tell him that. But you, my son, who knows right from wrong, you are beyond excuse. And this is exactly what Paul is talking about with respect to the circumcision. You're my son. My name is on you. You should know better. And so that sets us up into this question of, is it better to be raised by someone who teaches them right from wrong, or better to not be so, because the person raised is held to a higher standard? And probably even the principal, when they brought them all into the principal's office, looked at Frank and said, even if we didn't have the security camera footage, you would have been on the list of regular suspects. Fair or unfair, probably the case. But you? I know your mother. I know your father. I know your siblings. You, well, it's worse for you. Because you knew better. That's kind of the argument that Paul is making here. So, what advantage has the Jew? In every way, The Jews are entrusted with the oracles of God. The Jews were raised right. They were given the law. So when the Jews violate the law given to them by Moses, in some ways, the Jews, because they're held to a higher standard, are in some ways punished more severely. And this is tied up in the story of Israel as well. They are chosen both for special treatment and therefore, in some ways, for special consequence. Why? Now, the principal might then say to your child who got caught, I am going to make an example of you. Now, that connects up with the Jews because, in a sense, their election elected them both for being raised in a better home, but also as an example to the world about violating the mediated law. What if some were unfaithful? Does the faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? Ooh. This gets a little deeper. Okay. So your son, who marked up the cars in the faculty parking lot, someone might say, now, Frank, we get that. His father skedaddled, was a deadbeat. His mother had a drug problem. He didn't have any supervision growing up, had to make his way on the streets. The fact that he did this shouldn't have, not a total surprise. But now you, let's give this kid a name. What name should we give this kid? We'll give him the Spanish name, Fulano. Paul. Paul, all right. Paul. Let's make it first personal here. Paul, your father's a preacher. Your mother works in the Christian school. You were taught right from wrong. You are a minister's kid. You should know better. Suddenly, and actually, it's good that it's fun that you mentioned that because preacher's kids tend to have a reputation. They have a reputation exactly for this kind of thing. And what it points to is, hey, now, wait a minute. It's fairly easy for us to understand that if you have a deadbeat dad and your mom has a drug problem, and, you know, you are only fed by virtue of food stamps, and you are in and out of juvie, and you were raised on the street. Yeah, I can kind of understand why you'll get in trouble. But what does it say about the church or the law of God? Or all of these other things that are supposed to yield, oh, come on in. We've only got 5 minutes left of class, so what's your name? Lori Ellen. Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming. So what does it say about the fact that preachers' kids are sometimes the most incorrigible? What does that say about the church? What does that say about the Bible? What does that say about the law? Because here's the funny thing. Now, maybe you have three kids, and all three kids you told them, don't play with the stove. But you know, let's say Paul, Ruth, and Lori. So those are Let's say Stan and Barb. So Stan and Barb are the parents. Paul, Ruth is the oldest. Paul is the middle child. Lori is the youngest. I'm going to take some liberties with the characters themselves in this, in case my mother and sisters are watching. But let's say Ruth is the dutiful child, and all Barb had to say to Ruth was, "Don't touch the stove." And Ruth would never touch the stove. And let's say Lori was the youngest child. She was the apple of their eye. And Lori said, "Lori, don't touch the stove." And if you say it in a little stern voice, Lori, "Yeah, okay, I'm not going to touch the stove." So Ruth and Lori are very good. But that middle child, "Don't touch the stove." That gets his wheels thinking. Oh, maybe mom's telling me not touch stove because the stove is fun. Maybe mom's holding out on me. And so every time mom isn't looking, what's on my mind? Just because mom said, "Don't touch the stove," suddenly all I can think about is the stove. Now, actually, there's a very famous story about this by Augustine, who was a church father, that wrote about a bunch of pears. There were some pears in a field, and there was someone else's field, and Augustine and his friends went and stole the pears. And he reflects on this in a book called Confessions, because he's going back over his life and thinking about himself. It's an ancient work of psychology. And he thought about the pears, and he said, "They weren't particularly good pears. We weren't hungry for pears. In fact, after we stole the pears, we fed them to pigs." So we didn't even want the pears. What was it about the pears that drove us to steal them? They were forbidden fruit. Oh, now we're really tying some stories together. Someone told me not to touch the pears. Something inside of me, once I heard not to do it, I wanted them. Why? Oh, there's a complicated question. But this is what we're wrestling with now, in that, well, was it good to be a Jew when God gave the covenant and the law? Because the Jews were held to a higher standard. They said, "You shall have no other gods before me." Out there in the rest of the world, they had all sorts of gods, and they did whatever, and they could pursue and satisfy their appetites. But the Jews, no, you're held to a stricter standard. Well, maybe I want to be treated like everyone else. Really? So back to the previous story. Oh, Paul, you who are raised in my house, and Frank, you who were raised, not raised by the deadbeat dad who skedaddled, not raised by the mother who had the drug problem, would you rather have grown up in that house? Well, what do you mean? Well, every day when you woke up in my house, mom said, "Good morning. Here's breakfast. Here's your clothing for school. Here's your lunchbox. Here's your thermos. Did you get your homework done?" Frank's mom never asked about the homework. Did you get your homework done? Do you need some help with your homework? Frank's mom never helped with the homework. You really want to live in Frank's house? Oh. Well, why don't you go try it for a few days? See how you like it. See how you like opening the fridge and there's nothing in there, and having to go get food on your own, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So next week, we'll talk about that. And we're also going to talk about an even more difficult question. Well, if God gave special treatment to the Jews, why didn't God give special treatment to everyone? That's a lot harder question. And we'll talk about that next week. So, all right, let me close in prayer. Lord, we thank you for the book of Romans that teaches us and raises difficult questions for us. And we ask, Lord, that you would be with us as we wrestle with these questions. And we ask, Lord, that you would give us wisdom. So be with us this week, Lord, and give us your peace. This we ask in the name of Jesus. Amen.